Welcome to Book Club, and the edition that marks our 20th anniversary. Two decades on Radio 4, more than 200 writers in discussion with groups of avid readers. So it's surely appropriate that on this happy birthday, we welcome back one of those authors, Margaret Atwood, who's the first of them to appear twice on the programme. We're going to talk to her about her 1980s novel, The Handmaid's Tale, which has recently reached a vast new audience in the television adaptation. The story of the imaginary American state of Gilead, where Puritanism and repression have extinguished the human freedoms we all like to take for granted, and where the women who are known as handmaids have been turned into virtual slaves, their only function being to reproduce. A nightmare world, described by the narrator Offred, a handmaid herself, who reveals how a totalitarian regime, violent and unforgiving, wrapping itself in a language just as cold and twisted as Orwell's newspeak, has swept away all the democratic structures. Yet at the end of the novel, we are deliberately taunted with a little sliver of hope we can't say for sure. Margaret Atwood, welcome to Book Club.
Thank you.
And welcome too to this month's group of readers in Broadcasting House, which today includes some writers who've themselves been guests here and have sat in that chair. They will ask some questions and introduce themselves as we go. Margaret, when you wrote this in the mid-80s, people were concerned about these kinds of things, of course, because they always are, the removal of personal freedoms and the imposition of some kind of new regime. I think many people would say that it's a book that appears to be even more relevant at this moment than it was then. Do you feel that?
Say not seems. It is. Yes, it is. And that is why I think people are so tuned onto it as a television series, plus the fact that it's very well done. But the people in the cast and crew woke up on November the 9th in mid-shoot and said, we're in a different show.
This is 2016 and the American
That's
election.
That's right, right after the Trump election. And it's not that anything in the script changed. All of that remained the same, but the frame changed. So they knew immediately that people are going to be looking at this differently. And if you followed U.S. state-by-state politics, you will have seen several states just closing down on women's rights, and particularly women's health and reproductive rights. And you will have witnessed at least one candidate saying women shouldn't have the vote. Well, we've fixed all that in the future.
You watching this, of course, from just across the border in Canada, in Toronto, where you live. Let's have our first question.
Hello, Emer McBride. Was the impetus for beginning work on The Handmaid's Tale art or anger, and are they inextricable?
Well, you know, you never actually know. Ursula K. Le Guin, who just recently died, has a very good piece in her latest book, which is called No Time to Spare, and the piece is called On Anger. And what she talks about is anger as an impetus, as a propelling sort of rocket fuel. But if that's all you do, then you start spinning your wheels. So the anger has to go somewhere. And for some people, it goes into action. For other people, it goes into art. For some people, it goes into both. But to say that you can separate, and we're back into the old debate, art for art's sake. So let's just say that everything human is joined at the hip with everything else that's human. And art is deeply human. So are ideas about how society should be run and how other people ought to behave.
Thank you, Emma. Let's have a first question from one of our readers here.
Which came first? Was it the concept of Gilead or the handmaid?
Let us go back in time and talk about the three things that fed into writing The Handmaid's Tale. One of them was U.S. history, which I had to study as a Harvard graduate student in the early 60s at a time when the Harvard English Department did not hire women. Somebody wrote me a letter when that book came out and said, has nobody figured out that this book is about the Harvard English Department? So back in U.S. history, you come to the 17th century and you come to the Puritans, a form of religion that was particularly difficult for women. Not only did you get all of the female saints plus the Virgin Mary more or less kicked off the podium, but you also had other systems of belief, culminating in the Salem witch event. So that whole set of beliefs is in the background, and I get to say bad things about it because my ancestors were involved. This kind of thing goes underground as you follow U.S. history, but it's always there. And then you have periods when it comes up again, and we're in one of those right now. So there's that strand. There's the utopia-dystopia strand. As an adolescent person, I did what a lot of adolescent people do, which is read a lot of sci-fi, spec, fic, fantasy, and horror. And you can say that Handmaid's Tale is all of those, except maybe not the fantasy. I don't think we'll get the outfits. They might not all be red, but but a lot of the rest of it is really, some of it's already there. Reading all of that, particularly the 1984 Brave New World strand, as a young person, I thought, I would like to write one of these. What a challenge. But I also thought, there aren't very many female leading people in them. There are female people in them, but they're likely to be secondary characters. And the third one was in the 80s, we were in a backlash period. We'd had second wave feminism at the beginning of the 70s, and that went on for a while till people sank exhausted to the floor. And in the 80s, there was a lot of pushback. So I was reading about that, and I was reading about what people said they would like to do if they got power. So those were the three strands. And I kept a big clippings box because I didn't want anybody saying to me, what a twisted, weird imagination you have. I said, this has all happened, or it's happening.
Here.
The idea of a handmaid who bears children being separate from a wife who has an elevated status, I found quite interesting. What inspired it? Were they cultures you found where it was already happening?
It's biblical. These people say they are biblical literalists. So my reply is, how literal do you want to be? So do you want to go back to Rachel, Leah, and the two handmaids? Because that's who produced the 12 tribes of Israel. It wasn't two wives. It was two wives and two handmaids. And the handmaids have nothing to say in that account. The wives are saying, here's my handmaid. I get the baby.
And here.
I was wondering where the ants get their orders from, how much autonomy they have.
The ants, we should say, are enforcers of discipline, to put it mildly.
Well, that's a pretty good analogy. They are the disciplinary force within the group of women. And they, of course, have certain privileges and powers, therefore. But they're not on a level with the commanders.
So you mentioned about women controlling women, and it seems that The Handmaid's Tale is less interested in how the patriarchy is perpetuated by men than in how it's upheld by women, particularly the wives and the aunts.
Consider the alternatives. These women don't have much choice anymore. When you say people are willing to do something or complicit or any of those things, you have to say, within what system? Is this a free choice? Sophie's choice, you know, which of your children would you like to have killed? Is that a free choice? So if it were a free choice, you'd say neither. That's not the choice on offer.
I agree. And I think Aunt Lydia expresses that when a hidden vulnerability, when she admits, don't think it's easy for us either. Is
no,
that fair to say?
That's right. Because they too have had quite a lot of freedom and autonomy removed from them. Alone among the women, they're allowed to read. In fact, they kind of have to be able to keep track of things, but they too are within this system.
Hi, Ali Smith. In Negotiating with the Dead, which is your book about writing and why we write, one of the best books I've ever read on both those things.
Oh, Ali.
I know, it is, it's true. You have this moment where you give us some caveats, and one of the caveats is, watch out for the zeitgeist. It is not always your friend. I wonder if, say you were coming to a story like The Handmaid's Tale now, or just maybe generally, you could tell us how we survive a zeitgeist which presents itself as if it wants to befriend us, particularly in the way that we have facial recognition technique and it wants to know all our algorithms. How do we survive?
Yes, I think you just keep living. If you can keep alive long enough, it will change. We try out ideas and then they don't work the way we thought they should, and then there's a revision of how those ideas should work. And that's just the way we go on.
And a follow-on question from that. While our world leaders are, shall we say, so openly treating disdainfully truth and treating it with mischief, why does fiction matter? And does it matter more than it ever has?
Yes, okay, lying world leaders. Nothing new there. It is actually an old story. Why does fiction matter? Storytelling is one of the oldest human technologies we have. And what does fiction allow you to do? It allows you to try out without actually having to do it. Probably it was a big educational tool amongst earlier human beings because you could say to children, for instance, this is going to be a story about how your uncle Jim got devoured by a crocodile right over there. And then you tell a gruesome tale, and the child is not going to go swimming there. They don't have to test it out. So utopias and dystopias are ways of testing out possible arrangements of society without actually having to do them.
It's time, I think, to hear Offred's voice, the narrator, so we believe, of The Handmaid's Tale. Set it up. Tell us where we are in the story at this point.
When the handmaids go out for their daily walk, which is necessary to keep them in shape, of course, they're sent shopping because the devil makes work for idle hands to do. They have to have a task, and they go shopping with their baskets to shops where there are no written labels. It's pictures, because women are not allowed to read. And they have to go in pairs. Where did I get this? The nuns, of course. always went out in twos, at least. So they have shopping partners, which are other handmaids. So here is Offred waiting for her shopping partner to come along. And they're wearing long red garments because people in the society are color-coded and costume-coded, as people were for thousands of years before democracy, before we all took to wearing jeans. So because you could tell, you could look at somebody and tell what part of society they were from. And in fact, there were laws about who could wear what in a lot of society so that there wouldn't be any mistakes. Blessed be the fruit, she says to me, the accepted greeting among us. May the Lord open, I answer. We turn and walk together towards the central part of town. We aren't allowed to go there except in twos. This is supposed to be for our protection, though the notion is absurd. We are well protected already. The truth is that she is my spy as I am hers. This woman has been my partner for 2 weeks. I don't know what happened to the one before. On a certain day, she simply wasn't there anymore, and this one was there in her place. It isn't the sort of thing you ask questions about. Anyway, there wouldn't be an answer. This one is a little plumper than the last. Her eyes are brown. Her name is Offglen, and that's about all I know about her. She walks demurely, head down, red-gloved hands clasped in front, with short little steps like a trained pig's on its hind legs. During these walks, she has never said anything that was not strictly orthodox, but then neither have I. She may be a real believer, a handmaid in more than name. I can't take the risk.
We should explain at this point, for people listening who don't know the book, the origin of these names,
yes.
Offred and Offglen. I mean, Offred, literally of Fred,
yes.
The property of Fred and the property of Glen.
That's right. Well, they're just like all the patronymics. So Mrs. This, Mrs. That, De, Von, etc.
So it's not as odd as we might think at first glance.
No, not at all. I just rearranged it a bit.
You're listening to Book Club on BBC Radio 4, and to mark 20 years of the programme, we're talking to Margaret Atwood about The Handmaid's Tale.
Since you read 1984 and Brave New World, I was kind of wondering, why did you make the choice to have Offred be a slightly less rebellious character, or kind of putting kind of what she wanted slightly before the rebellion? Like, why did you make that choice ultimately?
Well, I would say, again, it's a question of what's on offer. She's a single individual. She isn't in touch with any other people who might be doing underground things, such as Quakers. You have to take totalitarianism seriously. There were counter-movements within Nazi Germany. Those people all got caught and they were executed. What would she do? She has her little minor rebellions. The thing about these regimes, and when I was writing the book, I went to East Germany and Czechoslovakia and Poland, all of which were still behind the Iron Curtain. You had to be very careful who you talked to, and you didn't know who to trust. And now that we've gotten into the records of the Stasi in East Germany, we know how very true that was. So you could have a conversation with somebody about, wouldn't it be nice to kick over this regime? And they could be an informer, and most likely would be. In the television series, of course, it's an American television series. So it's part of their DNA that, of course, you would then have the American Revolution somehow within this regime. That's how they think. So, and they have to make her more active.
So it's a more optimistic reading of the story than your own.
And more pessimistic. They thought of nasty things that I didn't even put in there. But they, but they stuck to the central rule, which is nothing goes in for which they cannot show a precedent. And they're being very careful about that. They have a researcher. So if you come up with some particularly weird thing, the question will be asked, has this ever happened, yes or no?
Our book group recently read The Power by Naomi Alderman.
Yes.
So I've thought a lot about how power corrupts. And it made me think again that if I wasn't an Offred, would I be a Serena Joy, who actually is Pam and is pretending because that's the role that's been imposed on her? Or could I even be an Aunt Lydia? It's not an easy answer, because if I was in enough fear and had less power, I could collude. I'm afraid I could.
Well, as a lot of people did. So populations are always very divided under those circumstances. Because, of course, if you were in the French Resistance and you pulled off an event, then a village gets massacred. They're never easy choices.
There are a number of references in the book to the ways in which Gilead's government has altered or edited the Christian Bible for their own purposes. I think it's mentioned even more than control of the news, which is sort of a staple of dystopia. The idea of the perversion of Christianity more widely is a thread running through lots of aspects of the narrative, but I was wondering if you could say a bit more about what you meant specifically with perverting
what
of the Bible.
The Christian thing? Okay, so it's the answer to the question, if you're going to have a totalitarianism in the United States, what kind of totalitarianism would it be? And it would not be, hi, my name is Bob, I'm a communist, and I'm now going to run your country. That will not happen. But these are people who are doing what a lot of people in the Republican South have done, which is God is on our side. And of course they would change the text, because the text contains things that are not things they would wish to do. They're not into loving your neighbor. They're not into the least shall be first. So of course they need to change it. And they're really going back much more to the Abrahamic part of the Bible, which was polygamous. And that's where the Mormons got it. One of the few developed on the actual soil of North America religions is the Mormons.
Could I just ask about the commander, because we haven't really touched upon him yet. Was there a temptation to make him more kind of monstrous than you did in the end? Because you gave him some very kind of human qualities, made him more interesting. It was quite shocking almost when Offred first arrives and he just wants to play Scrabble. That's his first kind of
I know.
Opening, isn't it?
When you delve into these things, you know, you go into characteristics of totalitarian regime people. Sooner or later, you're going to hit the attempt to make smiling Joe Stalin a friendly, huggable human being. In the United States, you would get quite a lot of, you know, we did it in your best interest. There would be a lot of that. And you will also get the usual spiel. My wife doesn't understand me. Because all of these commanders, of course, as we read in the afterword, then there's going to be purges. So as in Nazi Germany, as in Stalinist Russia, there were purges. People who thought that they were on the inside suddenly found that they were not only on the outside, but dead. So where else to turn for your moments of relaxation than to somebody who can't rat on you?
Evie Wilde, I wonder if there's something on the horizon in science or technology that either excites you or terrifies you.
There are a lot of things happening in technology, thinking of biotechnology in particular. You can make embryos out of skin cells. And this could be either taken as, hooray, parthenogenesis, we can have a society that's all women because we'll just make other versions of ourselves. Or it could be, boo, there is now no need for women. They haven't got the glass bottles yet. We're not yet in Brave New World.
I wanted to ask about Nick, because I find him really difficult to figure out, and I can't work out if Nick and Offred are actually in love or if this is something entirely artificial that is a comment on what happens to love in totalitarian regimes.
To make it clear, I mean, she has an affair with Nick, which becomes...
Well, she has a mandated affair with Nick.
Yes, but it becomes something more than that, doesn't it? Or it appears to.
Yeah, as it very well possibly would.
It's mandated by Serena, but...
Absolutely.
It seems like it goes beyond the remit that sort of Serena
set. Well, as it might well, put yourself in that situation. He is an embedded resistance person, which we find out quite far on. But again, she doesn't know whether she can trust him or not, and vice versa. You don't know in these regimes. In fact, you don't know if you're working for a bank who might be your secret enemy. So yes, something like that well might happen. Doing the forbidden thing is in itself a rebellion.
Do you think a Gilead-type regime is more or less likely in the West than it was when you wrote the book in the 1980s?
I think it's more or less likely in the West. It's not likely in England, because you did it already in the 17th century.
You mean we got it out of our system, or at least
Well, sort of.
England,
I think
did.
You had your religious wars, and you had Oliver Cromwell, and then you didn't like it, and you had the Restoration, and then you had Restoration comedy, and then the United States has never done that. They've had civil war, but it wasn't a religious war. So it's more likely in the United States than it was when I wrote the book. Might be a return to, quotes, traditional values, lie down on the floor and let me put my foot on your head, but unlikely under a religious banner, much more likely under a sort of revisionist, pseudo-biological weirdo thing.
And oftentimes the historical notes tend to seem to get forgotten about, but I wondered what your intention was with it, particularly in the sense of framing Offred's story as a male academic narrative, especially
sort
in a society that
but not entirely.
Post-Gilead.
Okay, it's partly what happens to history, is it not? So some cataclysmic event happens. Let's take the Battle of Waterloo, because it's far enough away. We're not going to dispute the fact that Napoleon did not win the Battle of Waterloo. But we then get quite a lot of chat about why he didn't win it. Was it because he had piles? I read quite a lot of military history. Who won is not disputed, but the reasons for this and that are endlessly talked over. And the other element is the handmaid herself, inside the book, cannot have an overview. She can't. She's not allowed to read. The only things on TV are propaganda, as they are in totalitarian states. It's one of the first things you do when you take over a country is seize the communications networks and shut down the newspapers. This is not a recipe. So she can't know, but the reader has to know. In 1984, there's this book inside it, which Winston Smith reads, which may or not be true, but it tells him a version of how the world of 1984 happened. And at the end of 1984, there is an essay written in standard English in the past tense about Newspeak. So we know that that world has not succeeded. So I needed two things, being a great student of utopias and dystopias. How did we get there? And what happened then? And you can only do that in this book with an afterword of that kind.
And we need to understand the effect or the likely effect of the cataclysmic event.
Yes, we need to know what lay behind the cataclysmic event, because usually you don't get these totalitarian takeovers unless there's a lot of social unrest.
Which in this case is infertility and the lack of a future in that sense.
Yeah, so by the way, the male fertility rate in Western countries is now on the slippery downward slope. Part of this, what's going on, this pushback in the United States is because they're looking at a declining fertility rate.
That's why many people who read this book, perhaps in the last few years, quite a few decades after it was written, say that you are, for good or ill, some kind of prophet.
I'm not a prophet. I'm not a prophet because there is no the future. So there are an infinite number of possible futures. The one that we get is going to depend on how we behave now, but you're not doomed to just one of them.
Last question.
There are a couple of areas in the book where Offred offers a variety of possibilities. To what extent does that make her an unreliable narrator?
The variety of possibilities is really a pitch to the reader, as it is with other novels in which there are several possible endings, beginning with Charlotte Bronte's Villette. Would you like to believe this, or would you rather believe that?
Have you changed your mind on that question? Once, twice, or more often since
how
you wrote it?
How it might go? Does she get out of Bangor, Maine?
Yeah. Exactly.
On Wednesday, I think she does. And on Monday, it being the kind of day it is, I think she doesn't.
Just as I thought. Margaret Atwood, thank you very much for coming back to us and being our birthday guest on Book Club to talk about The Handmaid's Tale. Thanks also to our three novelists who've joined the reading group this month, Eamonn McBride, Ali Smith, and Evie Wilde. We're celebrating the programme all this week on Radio 4 Extra, where you can hear The Handmaid's Tale and also a cornucopia of Book Club programmes from the archive, each introduced by one of our favourite starring authors. That's at 6:30 each weekday evening. And do remember that there are 240 programmes in all on our website. Just search for Book Club and Radio 4 and you'll find it very easily. And if you want to come to a recording just like this one, on your own or as a small book group, this is where you can let us know. We do look forward to seeing you during the next decade, at least. Our next programme is going to be with Colm Toybean, talking about his novel Brooklyn. You can hear that one on the first Sunday of July. That's July the 1st. Meanwhile, keep reading along with us until next month and the next book.